My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process of the 12 steps outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, an ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the primary purpose of helping another drunk, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that is the great miracle in my life, and sometimes I forget it. I want to thank the committee, I know, and everyone involved in this conference for your labor of love and the service that's being done. There has not been a year since I've been sober that I haven't been on at least one conference committee, and I know why you do it. You do it because you love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the only way you can think. It's a way to pay it back, and thank you for your service. And I want to welcome the newcomers. I'm real glad you're here. I may be more glad you're here than you are. Who would have thought that the day I checked into my last detox, jumping out of my skin, my nerves shot, no one on earth that cared about me or would have anything to do with me, the lowest day of my life, that I would celebrate that day for decks or decades to come? Who would have thought? I wouldn't have. If you would have come up to me as I'm checking in there, begging for a bed, and said, "Well, you're going to want to have a party in the future over this day," I said, "Leave me alone." I want to welcome you if you're new. I'm glad you're here. I know something you don't know. Something if I told you, you wouldn't believe. I know what can happen to you here. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what can happen to you here. The problem is, if you're like me, there's somebody that's tagging along with you that's going to screw it up for you from time to time. And that's you. So I suggest you get a sponsor right away. Don't wait. Don't wait. Get one right away. Don't wait for the perfect person. I was waiting for sort of a combination of Jesus Christ and Rockefeller, kind of. And said I got this guy that brought a meeting into the detox, who I thought didn't know why he was there. I thought, this guy doesn't have a life. And I didn't know that he was a servant in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why he was in that detox meeting, bringing meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, as I have been taught to do and have done weekly and biweekly for my whole sobriety. If you're new, this is different here. You will not understand this for a little while. I'm telling you, it's first of all, it's the only organization on the planet where you come in a big shot and you work your way up to servant. Everywhere else, it's the other way around. You'll come in and you'll just sweep the floor, and maybe someday, if you're lucky, you'll be a manager. Here, it's we all come in smart. You know, we all come in, we're the smartest person in the room, and if you're very lucky, you get to be a servant. You will find a way to intermittently push yourself aside for a greater purpose. And you'll find yourself clamoring back into the center repeatedly, and the chronic nature of the spiritual malady. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. My parents weren't alcoholic. There was alcoholism in my family, but I never saw it. I had no evidence of it. I came from a wonderful childhood. A childhood where I was loved and nurtured and given opportunities and cared for. I understood it. I understood intellectually that I was loved. But I was so self-absorbed and self-focused, even as a little kid, I couldn't feel it. I was that internally focused. Now, my sister, who's pretty well-adjusted, pretty normal, pretty out here, pretty lives in reality, not like me, lives in reality, felt the love in our family. She talks about it. I could see it and understand it intellectually, but I couldn't feel it. And there was something wrong with me that didn't make any sense to me, because I came from a childhood that I should have been grateful to have, and yet I always wanted to be somewhere else. I was just thinking about this earlier. I had a guy that in junior high school I started hanging around with, and his mom and dad were terrible alcoholics, and they would beat him sometimes, and his dad would punch holes in the walls. And one time, all five or six of the family had to sleep in the car because he came home from school, and the apartment was padlocked. And his dad was in and out of jail and carried weapons and was covered with tattoos. This was not in the days when tattoos were chic. And he was violent and hostile, and this kid grew up. And what I look back on now is a horrific childhood. And I remember at times going over to his house and feeling like, this place is cool. My parents go to church. They pay their taxes. They always try to do the right thing. They are boring. They were embarrassing. They were embarrassing to me. Where this guy's parents, man, now that's a family. And isn't that weird? And no matter where, if you're an alcoholic of my type, wherever you are, it's not really where you need to be. You don't know where you need to be, but it's not here. It's always somewhere else. And I had that as far back as I can remember. Our book calls it restless, an inability to feel settled in my own existence, in my own life. And I had this loneliness. I had this fear. I was the kid who didn't feel like the other kids looked at. It seemed like all the kids in grade school just kind of got along and played with each other, and with an ability that just seemed to be beyond me. And I worried about stuff. I was always obsessed in my mind with what you thought of me. And I ain't right. There's nobody I look around and I don't see anybody struggling with the stuff I seem to be struggling with. So I did what a lot of guys like me do. I became the pretend person. I became the guy who pretended he was all right. And I'm not all right. I became the guy who pretended he wasn't afraid. And I'm afraid a lot. I became the guy who pretended he fit. And I don't fit anywhere, really. I became the guy who pretended he was all right, and I'm not. And those of us who have lived, as the book refers to it, the double life, who create the facade, and we cower behind it. If you're like me, I developed an anxiousness and an apprehension and a fear of being found out. So, you know, when you're like that, you're coming from behind, you can't ever really be tough enough. You can't ever really act cool enough. You can't pretend enough. And I'm always coming from behind. And when I was 12, almost 13 years old, I was hanging around a bunch of older kids. And I wanted to be with these kids. I wanted to fit with these kids so bad. I heard Jim the other day talk about it. It was my exact experience. These were the kids that were in and out of juvie. These were the kids, the older kids, that when they walked into a dance at school, the other kids got out of the way. When you're secretly weak and pathetic, oh my God, I want to be like that. I don't want to be the guy that's scared all the time. I want to be the guy who's scaring people. You know what I mean? And because they had a power. I didn't even understand that even as a little kid, before I ever found alcohol, that lack of power was my dilemma. I didn't even understand that I had a quest and a yearning for power because of my vacancy within me. And I'm hanging around with these kids, and I'm trying, I'm loud, and I'm swearing, and I'm smoking cigarettes, and I'm stealing stuff, and I'm fighting, and I'm doing everything, hoping to feel like they look, and I ain't. We pulled a burglary one day in the town I lived in. We broke into somebody's house, and I'm a young wannabe gangster, and all these older kids, they go right by the TV set and the stereo, which I'm going, and they go right to the alcohol. But they knew something I didn't know. They knew there was power in the alcohol. I didn't know that. I had never even seen anybody drunk. I didn't even know. I knew it was for adults. That was about all I knew about it. I didn't even know it got you high. I didn't know that. And I'm with these kids, and we're passing around. I remember the label today. This quart of Seagram 7. I remember the 7 crown on the label. They're passing it around. And when you're a phony guy, like when you're a phony, you got to watch people. And then you try to emulate what they do, right? Because that's the kind of guy I am. And I'm noticing that there was a kid. One of the kids took a big hit off this quart of whiskey, and he got a lot of very cool attention from the other kids. So by the time the bottle gets to me, I'm in. You know, I'm going to take a big hit of this. I'm just glad it wasn't cat urine, because I'm in. You know what I'm saying? I'm taking a hit off this bottle, and I took a big hit off this bottle, and oh my God, they didn't tell you about the burning. Oh man, it felt like my whole plumbing was being eaten alive. And somehow I kept that down. I don't know how I did it. I kept it down. And when the burning stopped, something happened to me that I never realized for many, many years that would change the course of my life. And I started to approach a feeling of completeness that I never knew was available to me. A feeling that I couldn't pretend enough to get. A feeling that I couldn't be tough enough to get. A feeling that nothing I've ever tried ever even brought me into the zip code. And it was amazing. And in the early days of drinking, in the days when the hook is set, alcohol does something for me that if when you think about it objectively, if it didn't do that for me, I would not let it do to me in the later years what it's going to do to me if I ain't chasing what it one time did for me. And what it did for me was spectacular. I'm a mope. I'm a guy who doesn't fit anywhere. And I could get half lit up, man, and I'd get on a pool table. It's like you get in this zone. You can't miss. It's like I would blow my own mind with the shots I'm making. I can't do that sober. It gave me the courage and the freedom to get up on stages and play music. And I couldn't do that sober. It gave me the ability to dance. I can't dance. Oh, not at all. But you get me half drunk, man. The rhythm of the universe flows through me, man. I'm like, wow. Where's that coming from? It gave me the ability to talk to girls. I couldn't talk to girls. I'm telling you. I don't mean to be crude, but if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd be celibate to this day. I could have never walked through that terrible, terrible feeling of insecurity. I remember one time, junior high school, I'm a guy, I live my life in my head. I just drive by for reality occasionally. I live in my head, and because I live in my head, there's a girl in my class that I'm, oh my God, I'm obsessed with her. It's so bad. That not only can't I talk to her, if she's in the same class I'm at, I can't even look in that side of the room. You know, she just makes me nuts. And I'm gonna go to this dance, and I'm gonna ask her to dance. I'm having these. I already know the college our kids are going to go to, you know what I mean? But no, I mean, I've had 5,000 conversations with her in my head. I have not had one with her in reality. So I'm psyched up, and I'm going to go to this dance. It's in this gymnasium, and I'm plastered up against that wall in fear. I didn't know it was fear. I didn't know what it was. I just felt horrible. Watching her and her girlfriend dance, and I'm trying to psych myself up to go ask her to dance. And I can't. And every song I do that battle, and I can't. I keep saying, all right, next song, I can't do it. Can't do it. I finally just surrender in a depression, just sulked out of that gymnasium, went out to the parking lot. I felt like I should wanted to end my life. And a couple buddies of mine are out there with a six-pack of diet, with a six-pack of regular Coke and some 151 rum. I loved 151 rum. I love. Is there any 151 rum drinkers here? In case you're new and you're delusional, I want to give you a piece of information. I'm just saying, there is no social drinking of 151 rum. It doesn't exist. You drink 151 rum and Everclear just for one thing. Just get downtown now. That's it. I loved it. And I drank a couple rum and cokes, man, and I got lit up, and I could float back into that gym with a suave fair and a confidence, and just went over to her and just started talking to her, and words are coming out of my mouth. I don't know where they're coming from. I'm channeling somebody or something. It's amazing. I had this out-of-body experience as I'm listening to myself talk to her, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this could work. This is amazing. And then you know what happens. If you're like me, you sober up and you're back to being you again. And I never liked that much. And I never understood that. I never understood that. I never liked myself. To me, Silkworth says a wonderful thing. He says to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. No matter how much trouble I get into, no matter how much I burn my life to the ground, I feel more normal under the influence of alcohol than I ever felt sober. And that doesn't even make sense to me in the light of the problems that occur more and more frequently over the years. See, I'm a guy who gets in trouble a lot. I'm a guy who gets arrested a lot. I don't mean to. Nothing dramatic. I mean, there was a time I fancied myself a gangster until the police explained I was a public nuisance. I get arrested for pathetic things. Peeing behind a building, you know, just... What are you here for? Peeing behind a building? Not good. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I'm getting in trouble. I'm not even 16 years old. I'm getting sent away for the first time. I'm in this juvenile court judge's chambers, Judge Hess. I took my daughter and we went back to the town I grew up in, and I got to show my daughter everything, and she got to meet some people that I grew up with, and it was amazing. And I was in this Judge Hess's chambers for the third time. This is not good. My mother and father loved me. My mother and father would go to incredible lengths financially, emotionally. Anything they had to do, they'd call up best friends, they'd call in favors, anything to help me. My parents literally spent a life's fortune on therapists and treatment centers and probation and fines and lawyers and just endless stuff on me. And till they eventually couldn't do it no more because I ripped their heart out over the years. But at that time, they would have done anything to help me. And they're in that courtroom, and through a series of bargains with the judge, I had to go somewhere to live for a while, but it wasn't as bad as what it could have been. And I don't know why I'm in that courtroom. If you would have asked me, I would have told you it's because of snitches. I would have told you it was because of a society that likes to curtail real human freedom. But the real truth is, I'm in that courtroom because there's something wrong with me. That when I go out to party with my buddies, I have an absolute inability to shut her off when I start. I don't know why. I party with some guys that can get drunk, but they go right up to the edge of the abyss and they can see it's going to become bad and they go home. It's like they have an off switch. I don't have an off switch. And once I start, I can't stop. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that I had the definitive characteristic of alcoholism, and that's an allergic reaction to alcohol. That every time I take a drink of alcohol, something happens to me that only happens to people with a disease called alcoholism. And, you know, we live in a funny day and age when a lot of people are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous are very confused about whether they're alcoholics. And treatment centers will ask you stupid questions. They ask you things like, what's your drug of choice? What do you got? I mean, I don't know. I drank vanilla extract a couple times. I broke open a magic marker in jail and huffed it, hoping something might happen, you know? What they should ask is, what happens to you when you drink alcohol, Bob? When you have two drinks of alcohol and the effect from the alcohol starts to spread throughout your system, do you break out in an irresistible yearning for more? That our book calls a phenomenon of craving. And I always had that. There's a test in our book. It's a test not recommended much anymore. I remember the days when it used to be. I remember watching old-timers stick a $10 bill in some new guy's face and say, here, go find out if you're an alcoholic. Try some controlled drinking. You don't see that much anymore. Maybe we've just gotten cheaper. I don't know. But if you were to take the test in the book and you were to do what it says go over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. If you're like me, you're not going to get a good read. And the reason, if you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, you're not going to see the test. The test's not going to work for you. Because I'm going to go in the bar to see if these people in AA are full of crap, whether I got this allergic reaction. I don't have an allergic reaction. I don't die. Nah, I'm not that. Nah. Couldn't possibly have that. But I'm going to see. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to have two drinks. And then I got to shut her down and go home. Now, you can't go smoke nothing, take nothing, nothing, nothing. Two drinks, that's it. Well, halfway through that second drink, it become very apparent to me that this is a bad test day. It's just a bad test day. Because that game's on television. Oh, my God, I got to watch that game. I can't leave now. It's a bad test day. Or some girl would walk in. I'd think, oh, my God, that could be her. I can't leave now. Or Rick would come in. Rick's always got something good to smoke. I got to have a drink with Rick. Bad test day. Tomorrow would be a better test day. And I never understood how this disease uses my own mind against me. That as the phenomenon of craving starts to be activated within me from this allergic reaction to alcohol, it uses my mind and all its abilities of justification and rationalization to make me think that this next drink I'm now about to order, even though I said to, that the third one is my idea. I think it's not a craving. I've just changed my mind. And this disease punks me out like that over and over again. And the sad thing is, I don't know what's happening here. See, it's got me convinced that it's my idea, and it's not. Well, the problem with having alcoholism, it's a progressive disease. In the beginning, for several years, man, it's a lot of fun. It's a little bit of problems. And as the years go on, the problems increase and the fun gets more and more elusive. And I don't know what's happening to me. And I'm desperately trying to jumpstart a party that's getting vaguer and more distant and harder to access. And I don't know what's wrong. I throw every drug I can in the mix. I start suspecting that I have mental illnesses. If you take a guy like me and you get me sober in a treatment center and I'm 2 weeks sober and put me in front of a psychiatrist, let me tell you something. I'm going to get a diagnosis. And I've had several. I've been diagnosed by a pretty competent guy. It's clinical depressed. I had a diagnosis of free-floating anxiety and panic disorder. Alcoholism mimics a whole bunch of stuff. Isn't it? You know something very odd? I was talking to my doctor about this, and he thought it was an interesting concept that most alcoholics, because we're self-centered, that means we stare obsessively at our own little pains and little things and feelings and stuff. Because I'm self-centered, most alcoholics are hypochondriacs to some degree. I mean, how many people in this room besides myself have been convinced on various occasions you were dying of a terminal illness you didn't have? Anybody? All the time. I have at least 100 just amazing rehearsed deathbed speeches I've never gotten to say to anybody. So, to some degree, some of us are so narcissistic, we're hypochondriacs. Do you know there's one illness a hypochondriac never imagines he has? Alcoholism. A hypochondriac never goes into a doctor and says, Doc, I think I have alcoholism. And the guy says, you don't even drink. I mean, you know. No. Everything else, but not alcoholism. The disease is progressing within me, and I don't know what's happening to me, but it's getting bad. It's getting harder to get ease and comfort. It's getting harder to get relief. Because the truth is, and I never looked at this until I was sober a while, alcohol was medicine for alcoholism for a lot of years. And when the medicine stops working, oh my God, there's a place in our book where it talks about this bottom thing that we have. And it says we get to a place where there's nothing left. My sponsor talks about getting to a place where there's no friendly direction. Even the bottle, there's no hope anymore, even in the bottle. There's no hope in medications. There's no hope in changing towns. It's like you've done everything, and not just once, but you've tried it futilely over and over and over again, and there is no relief anywhere. And that's where guys like me start thinking about offing themselves, because there's nowhere to go. You know, alcoholism becomes such a lonely, lonely business. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I imagined all kinds of things. I remember I ended up in an emergency room one time, and I do that frequently because I hurt myself. I fall down. I get in a fit of rage. I'll put my fist through a window, and then I got to go and get stitches because I'm cut something. And I'm in this emergency room, and I've been in there for about 2 hours, and they gave me a couple stitches, and they've taken some X-rays to make sure, you know, there's nothing serious. So, you know, I'm kind of sobered up sitting in there. Now, I'm in there, and I got to wait for these X-rays to come back, and I'm sober. I need a drink really bad, and I don't know what to do, but there's a rack of medical pamphlets there. You know, like diabetes and heart disease and that kind of thing. And there's a pamphlet there that says the 7 warning signs of cancer. And I picked that pamphlet up and I started reading through it. And one of the warning signs was continued unexplained bleeding. And I remember reading that thinking, oh my God. I throw up. I get dry heaves and blood. I see blood. I get blood sometimes. Matter. Oh my God! Sometimes I'm bleeding out both ends. Oh, I got cancer. And then there was like an epiphany right behind that. It's metastasized to my brain. Oh, hey, this explained volumes of my life. It explained all the doing the weird, just out of character, crazy things that I can't remember. It explained why I just sink into these abysses of withdrawal, almost catatonic depression, why I'd fly off the handle at people with inappropriate responses and rage when they haven't even done anything. I have a brain tumor. Oh, my God. And I had this fantasy for a long time. I remember just sitting there in the park drinking Richard's Wild Irish Rose and thinking about how they're going to find out one day that I'm terminally ill with cancer. They're going to take me to a cancer ward. Of course, they're going to have to contact my mother and father, who would have nothing to do with me anymore. My mother and father thought I was a bum, and they're going to realize how wrong they've been about me. There's nothing better than when someone realizes you're right and they're right. That's like Christmas, isn't it? It's like wonderful. And then, of course, they're going to contact all my ex-girlfriends who thought I was a bum. And they're going to realize, oh, my God, maybe Bob really did love us and he had a brain tumor. And they're going to come running down to the hospital to beg my forgiveness. And if they were humble enough, maybe. And I loved it. I love living up in here, you know, and all that stuff. And I just love that. And I go into this treatment center, and this doctor's interviewing me, you know. Starts talking to me about alcoholism. I say, doc, I got a brain tumor. And he says, has that been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, It was verified by the smartest guy I know. I mean, so he gave me a whole battery of tests, and he comes back and he says, "You don't have a brain tumor. You have an ulcer and a hemorrhoid." Here's the kind of ego I have. I wanted a second opinion, right? I felt depressed. I mean, are you sure, Doc? My ego would rather have me be right and everybody else wrong and I'm dead than be free and alive. It's if you identify with that on any level, you do not have a high mental health quotient, let me tell you. And I don't know what's killing me. I don't know. I go through the last couple years as hideous because I'm not stupid. I get it. And I get into a treatment center, and or maybe in the county jail sometimes. I'd sobered up in jail. And I'd be swearing to myself, and I'd mean it. I don't think a human being could ever be any more sincere about not drinking again than I was. And I'd swear to myself, I'm never touching that stuff again. And then something that I don't understand would start happening to me, and I don't understand it. It's just insidious. When Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, talks about that when we quit drinking, we become restless, irritable, and discontent. See, I can't put my finger on that. All I know is that after a time, the shine of abstinence wears off, and I start feeling emotionally kind of squirmy. And I'm a guy who worries about stuff. I'm a guy who overreacts to people. I'm a guy who just, I told my first got sober, I told my sponsor, I'm just sensitive. And he said, sensitive? He said, sensitive people are sensitive to other people's feelings. You're only sensitive to yours. You're just self-centered. Well, you are. Where's the AA love? But when I stop drinking, I just get my emotions and my life kind of on me. Like, if you ever saw that movie Alien where that creature attaches itself to your face? How you doing, Bob?
Oh, I'm just hanging in there.
And what happens, it feels like I'm smothered here. And after a while, I can't take it anymore. After a while, day in and day out, and week in and week out, with this loneliness, I don't fit anywhere sober. I suffer from depression and anxiety all the time when I'm sober. The psychiatrists have tried different medications, tried everything with me. And at the very best, I get these little moments of hope where I think, okay, it's going to be better. And then I just start to recede back into being me again. And I can't stop it. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I don't know that it's alcoholism. It doesn't look like alcoholism to me because this is all occurring when I'm sober. I first get sober and I'm hopeful. And I seem like I'm good. I'm better now. And then I just start to deteriorate gradually into this thing until eventually I get to a place. I used to confuse me when people talk about the obsession to drink would come on you. There's something that happens to me before that. And I just start getting obsessed with getting free. I just get so tired of being locked up in here. And I don't want to hurt anybody. And I don't want to go back to jail. I just want to bust out, for God's sakes. I just want to get free. I just want to be able to come out and play again. I just want to get out of this god-awful loneliness. I just want to be able to talk to people and laugh. I just want to be free, that's all. And I don't know. And right behind that is a memory that is almost cellular of how at one time four shots of tequila would set me free. Now, when Silkworth says we can't differentiate the true from the false, the problem is that the last couple years of my drinking, alcohol didn't set me free anymore. But you can't see that when you yearn for freedom bad enough. All you can see is the hope of getting back to the old days when it was magic. See, the last couple of years of my drinking, I drink and feel sorry for myself. I drink and go on crying jags. From the day I started drinking out of the treatment center, I'd stop bathing. I'd feel so pathetic and so depressed, and I'd have so much self-pity. I was the guy that at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you're kind enough to let me sleep on your couch, I'd be on your phone calling people I went to grade school with. And I'd call ex-girlfriends and cry into the phone, "We should have gotten married." And their husband would be yelling at me, "Don't you call my wife!" You know? It's pathetic. You know, this is not a party. This is pathetic. I'd wet my pants and walk around in it, you know. I'm telling you, if you're 2 years old, diaper rash might be cute. When you're 20, it is not cute. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't think it's alcoholism because I'm so sick when I'm drinking, and then I'm so sick when I'm not. I've lost the ability to control my drinking, and I can't seem to control my abstinence either. And not from a lack of trying. I've taken the meds. I've been to the psychiatrist. I was hypnotized. I primal screamed. I'm embarrassed to tell you I primal screamed. I was in therapy. My mother worked for mental health, and my father was very politically connected. I got in to see some therapists that you had to be like a senator or a movie star to see because of my folks. And it never seemed to help me. And I always drink again. And I don't understand this dynamic. I don't know. Why is this happening to me? Why do I keep going back to it? There's so many times I think I'm out of the woods. There's so many times as I'm swearing to myself I'm never going to drink again. And I feel like I'm safe. I feel like I'm going to be okay now. And I always go back to it eventually. I saw a movie, probably 1980. And when I was watching this movie, I thought, oh my God, this is exactly what used to happen to me. And it was about the Cold War. And the communists had captured this CIA agent who was a spy. And evidently, this guy had some information, some secrets about a new aircraft, a new weaponry that the communists were just, they're hell-bent to torture this information out of this guy. But he's a tough, tough, macho CIA-trained spy. So they've had this guy tied to a chair for days and days and days. They've hit him with fire hoses. They've beaten him with whips. They cut off his little finger. They brought in a generator, and they had these wires that sparked, and they put these wires to the guy's private parts and turned the juice on, and he withered in agony for days, and he still didn't tell him anything. This is a tough guy. I'm the guy he'd just show the wires to. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I might act tough on those streets. I'm the guy you just show those wires to. I'm giving it up. What do you want? Anything, please. But they can't break him. They can't break him. He's been trained by the CIA, evidently. Can't break him. This little doctor, this little Chinese doctor walks in. He bows to the guy strapped to the chair. He says, "My name's Dr. Chang. You will tell me everything." And this macho American spy says, "Doc, you ain't going to get nothing out of me. What are you going to do to me? You going to torture me? You going to cut me? You going to cut off another finger? What are you going to do to me?" He says, "No, no torture. I give you Chinese water torture." He says, "Water torture? You already hit me with fire hoses. What are you going to do?" He says, "No fire hose. One drop." The guy goes, "One drop? Doc, hit me with a bucket of water. I ain't telling you." He says, "No bucket. One drop." And this tough CIA-trained guy who can resist pain at a level that's beyond human laughs at him. And he says, "Go ahead, Doc. I ain't giving you nothing." He brings this apparatus and puts it above the guy's head and starts. And he laughs. "Ah, Doc, I ain't telling you nothing. Hit me again, again. You keep doing it, Doc. I ain't telling you nothing." And after 3 days, he's begging him. He's begging him to please let me tell you everything I know if you'll just make it stop. And that is the insidiousness of this disease. In the in the light of what I have just done to myself and my conviction and understanding of what's going on, that I will never, ever drink again. I can't believe that a couple squirmy little uncomfortable emotions are going to break me into picking up a drink. You've got to be kidding me. And it just starts. Until eventually the day comes and I will do anything for freedom. And I have no idea what's happening to me. And people, and through these years, I am intermittently going to AA meetings. I seem like I'm not really alcoholic. There's something else more serious wrong with me, I suppose. I'm not really alcoholic, but every time I end up drinking, I end up in rooms where all the alcoholics are gathered. I don't understand what that's about. And I keep ending up in rooms of AA, and there were times when people in Alcoholics Anonymous really tried to help me. There were times when there was some brilliant counselors and psychiatrists who, some of them understood alcoholism very well, and they tried to help me, but you can't help me. I don't know that I'm that, I don't feel very good about myself, so I don't think that it's an ego problem. And the real truth is, I'm ego dominant, and I don't know it. I am hostage to my own obsessive self-involvement in this ego that never, ever stops talking to me. And I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. There was a great psychiatrist in Pittsburgh who's worked in the field of alcoholism for probably 50 years. And he's also a rabbi, and he's a brilliant guy named Dr. Abe Torsky. And Abe cornered me one time. I was in a treatment center. He was involved in several of them back there. And he cornered me and he said, the reason guys like you are going to relapse yourself to death and you never get better, even though you may find up to decades of abstinence, you will never get any better, he said, is because you're so ego dominant, you have an absolute inability to listen to anyone in order to hear anything new. You can only listen to see how you are already right. And I'll tell you, that's the way I am. I don't know I'm that way. I don't mean to be that way. But that's the way I am. I sit in meetings and I pick people apart. I'm so judgmental. And I don't know that I'm judgmental because I'm not judgmental. I'm right. And I don't like to judge alone, so I'm a gossip. I mean, I don't know I'm a gossip. I think I'm reporting accurate information is what I think I'm doing. Oh, I talk about your sex life or the one I imagine you have. I will talk about your dishonesty. I'll talk about your phoniness, because when you say you're really happy and everything, I know. And I just pick everybody apart. I remember sitting in a meeting and my ego is so defended, it will not let anything get in. It will not. I remember sitting in a treatment center and there was a brilliant speaker. I mean, a guy who was very famous in that part of the country. And he was talking. My ego was starting to feel threatened. I remember sitting there going, all of a sudden my ego goes, is that a toupee? Like it had to discount him. It had to discount him because it was threatened. It just does that. I just pick you apart. And so what happens is nothing new gets in. And if nothing new gets in, nothing changes. And I'm a closed system. I work, and this ego never goes away. And I'll tell you something. I've spent a lot of my sobriety working with new guys, and it seems like I didn't pick this, but the last 10 years I seem to work with a lot of people that are sober a long time. Because alcoholism is really cunning, baffling, and powerful. This ego is devious. It's smarter than I am. It will learn the steps, the book, the traditions, it will learn the program and then use it to its own self-grandizement. I did that and didn't even know I was doing it. I spent 9 years in general service. I have every position except delegate. I studied the traditions. And I didn't do any of that to become a servant. I did it to grandize myself up here above the herd, so I could obtain bragging rights and create an AA resume of things I could lord over you. I remember I got really good at the traditions, not because I wanted to be a better AA member, but so that I could go to meetings and just look for tradition breaks. Oh, and when I found one, it was like Christmas. I learned the big book and the steps for the same reason. And I don't even know that that's happening. I don't know. See, the greatest trick the ego ever does is convince me it doesn't exist. There's a great line in our book, and Bill Wilson had to have been divinely inspired. How could he see this stuff? He says in there, in chapter 5, he says that we are extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. If you're sitting in this room right now, when I said extreme example, what? Oh, not extreme. You just qualified for being an extreme example. Why does he say extreme? Why can't he be nice and say, you know, Bob, sometimes... No, he says, Bob, you're off the charts here. Here's the rest of the human race, a little bit self-centered, and then there's you, Bob. I mean, like, wow. And I don't think so, do I? And I went through something that a lot of us go through. And I love watching the guys I sponsor that in their first, somewhere in their first 8-10 years, they go through this thing. Sometimes it happens 3 years to 5 years, but you get to a point. You're going to a meeting every day, you're doing service, you've done some work in the steps, and you'll come to your sponsor, as I came to mine, and as the guys I sponsor will come to me somewhere in the first several years, and they'll have this terrible look on their face, and they'll say, I don't think AA is working, I'm getting worse. What do you mean you're getting worse? I wasn't this self-centered before. Yes, you were. Yeah, you were. Yeah, you just didn't think so until now. Yeah, that's all. The veil is lifted just enough so you're finally able to see what an idiot you've been all along. You've been this, and it seems that way. It seems like, oh my God, I've never this. I have been all my life. My mother knew that before I ever picked up a drink. She used to say, Rob, you're full of yourself. I never knew what she meant. But I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot. And I really am. My daughter, I love my daughter. I just have the most amazing daughter. She doesn't have alcoholism. In my family, it seems to skip every other generation, which is a hard thought, because it means chances are my grandkids will be alcoholic. But my daughter's not. She is one of the most spiritually attuned, naturally attuned people. It's just, she just automatically sees the right thing to do. She automatically, intuitively knows the right thing to do. She's a giver. She's altruistic. She spent her junior and senior year in high school working a job, getting good grades so she could save her money to go to Africa with a church group and live in a hut to help the poor natives. Junior and senior high school, I'm saving my money for a lid. I mean, right? I mean, my daughter is the person I was afraid you were going to make me out to be. I remember saying to the guy when I was new, what if God wants me to go to Africa and help the poor? And this guy says to me, he says, for God's sakes, you can't even hold a job. I mean, God's got doctorate degree people. He's got a lot of, he's not going to pick you. He's going to pick someone that's competent to go to Africa. My daughter, I mean, so not too long, about two years ago, my daughter was breaking up a relationship. And I'm her dad. I love her. I adore my daughter. And I was hanging out with her and, you know, trying to console her. And I don't know. They don't teach this stuff in school, so I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I'm trying to say daddy-like things to her and nice things. Like, I'm telling her things like, well, you your prince is going to come. You just have to kiss a few frogs first. I don't know what I'm saying, you know. I'm just trying to make her feel better. That's all, you know. I just say, he doesn't know what he's missing. You're just amazing. And I'm, you know, and I mean that. I really mean that. And she says, thanks, Dad. And she ends up going home that night. Well, almost a week goes by, and I get together with her, and we're having dinner. And I'm excited to see her. And the minute I sat down at the booth, I said, Kate, how's it going? She says, it's going good, Dad. I said, you know, with the relationship breakup, how's that going? Oh, she says, oh, Dad, you know, you got to move on. You can't hang on. You can't hang into stuff like that. I'm going out with a guy next week. You know, you just got to go on with your life. I'm looking at her, move on. Oh, my God, Kate, you couldn't have got enough mileage out of this yet. I would have dominated at least 5 discussion meetings. I would have made my sponsor's eyes glaze over 3 or 4 times. But see, my daughter isn't it an extreme example of self? She's not willing to drink of that situation like I'd see. I drink of that like I drink alcohol. I'm not a social feeler. I do everything alcoholically. And I really am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And there's a lot of people don't like to hear that, but it warns us in the book. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, like after 20 years, 30 years, 35 years, has to be smashed. I will always have a chronic, which means it never goes away. I will always have to deal with a disease called alcoholism. And I believe it's a spiritual malady, and the sickness is caused by an excessive ego disorder. There was a doctor, Dr. Bill Baer, in the 1940s, and Bill was asked to go to some AA meetings and read a little bit of our literature and check us out. Because we were getting a lot of attention. The National Council was being formed, had been formed. We were up for the Lasker Award the couple years prior. The Saturday Evening Post article had come out. Alcoholics Anonymous was starting to get a lot of traction, a lot of notoriety. So he went to check us out. He made a little report to the AMA. And what he said, a little piece of it, is reprinted in the back of the big book in the Medical View of Alcoholism. Dr. Baer nailed us. He said something that is so astute and brilliant that it astounds me that he could have gotten it just by checking us out. He said that we were people who knew that we must not drink, and some of us almost die getting to that point. And then he says, we throw ourselves into helping others with similar problems, and in that atmosphere of me helping people like me, he said the alcoholic will often overcome his excessive concentration upon himself. Is it that obvious? I mean, I think I was many years in the rooms going to 1 and 2 meetings a day before I woke up to that's the problem. I've got so much of me on me that I'm dying of loneliness in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because there's too much of me between me and you. And I can't bring God out of the theoretical and into the actual because there's too much of me between me and God. We talk about something in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't know if it's unique, but I don't hear it in many other places. We talk about conscious contact. There's been alcoholics for thousands of years drinking themselves to death with tremendous faith in God. I've sponsored some clergy. 2 of them drank themselves to death with amazing faith in God. That we have to take it to a new level, this thing called conscious contact. And we have to be able to learn how to trust this power. The difference between faith and conscious contact, if you're leaving here tonight and you're going to drive home, you get in your car with absolute faith that there are traffic laws and there are cops to enforce them, and that may affect your driving. You get a cop in your rear view mirror with these lights on, you've got conscious contact. One is of the mind, which really doesn't do us much good, and one is right here. And so I have to find a consciousness of God's presence in my life. And the best I've ever been able to do is intermittent because of the clamoring of self. I'm the guy, I can be one day, one morning, I could be through my prayer meditation. I'd be so hooked up, I need a tent and a tambourine. I mean, I'm me and God like this. And then it just starts. I'm like the back of a toilet tank. You can flush it and it empties out, and then I just start filling up with me again. You know? I don't mean to. It is the chronic nature of the disease. And as I fill up with me, God becomes distant and only a matter of the mind. It's not that I don't believe in God. I still have faith. There's just no actualization of it in my life. Because I go inside me to that place it talks about on page 55, we're supposed to find God. And I go, and I've filled up with me. I go inside me and I just run into a bunch of me. And there ain't no conscious contact with God. And I was sober a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous before I started just the first real serious endeavor in this process of self-reduction that starts on page 63 with a much-needed decision that can't be carried out, no matter how sincere it is, unless I start to dismantle this judgment machine that is the will. And I tell you, I read a lot of stuff, and I spent a lot of years in therapy, and I actually worked as a counselor. I worked as a therapist for a while. I was really good at it right up to the day I lost my job for being drunk on the job. And I've never seen anything anywhere in the world that is a more effective for ego reduction than our fourth step as it's outlined in the big book. Where you have to, your ego, you unleash your ego in the first three columns. You unleash it. You put down everybody that's wrong. Put down everybody that's stupid. List the idiots. Allow yourself. Indulge yourself. Put them all down. Really put down every person that, if there was any justice in the world, would owe you an amends, for God's sakes. Put them all down. Put them all down. And then we walk through a process, and then it takes us to a point where it says we're prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle. And what would that be? Well, I've been looking at it from the position of a prosecuting attorney. Now it's to get up and walk across the courtroom and now starting to have an internal dialogue as if I was them, looking at the situation between me and them from their eyes. And, you know, we all know we don't like it. The ego hates it because it threatens its being right. But we all know that their perception of what happened between you and them and my perception of what happened between me and them is going to be two different deals. Now the ego rises up instantly and says, but I'm right. What are the chances of that? Isn't it funny that how right I want to be? I bet you there's people in this room that would rather... They would rather be miserable, sleepless, isolated, where you have to walk around having conversations in your head with people, and you wouldn't bear all that internal torture rather than admit you might not be right. Right? Let me tell you something. If you're like that, you do not have a high mental health quotient. You're ego dominant. That your ego and its feeding is more important than your very well-being. And that's the guy. That's the problem. That's the guy I am. And I started this process. I listed all these people. Now I have to look at my mother and father and what my childhood was like from their eyes. What a horrible thing. I blamed them for so much. And they weren't perfect, as whose parents are. But they really tried, and I tried to blame. And when I looked at it through their eyes, I was ashamed of myself. When I looked at some of the women that I'd tried to date and have relationships with, and I looked at it, and I used to blame them for rejecting me and for all this. I looked at it from their eyes. I was ashamed of myself. When I looked at my sister, when I looked at my employers. And you know what starts to happen? I start to wake up. I start to realize why I was rejected and why I was fired. Because when you're looking at it through their eyes, it's like, well, of course, I would have rejected me too. I would have fired me too. The amazing thing to me is that they lasted and were tolerant of me as long as they were. I had to realize in most cases I would have had a shorter fuse than they had. That I was much more judgmental and much more critical than the rest of the world has ever been for me. And that I really was an egomaniac. And I was wrong. Isn't it funny? I did two inventories my first 4 years of sobriety. One was the life story where you put down every deep, slimy little secret you've kept to yourself, and didn't change anything in me. I did another one answering the 30-some questions in the fourth chapter of the 12x12, along with writing about a page in each of the seven deadly sins. Didn't change nothing. If you would have asked me what the exact nature of my wrongs was, completing those two fifth steps, I would have told you about the money I stole, some of the embarrassing sexual things I did, the lies I told. You would have asked me after I did the one out of the book, you know what I would have said? I would have said how wrong I was about my mother and father. How wrong I was about everything. Could you imagine anything that would reduce a guy like me's ego more than going through every judgment of the ego your whole life and wrong again? And if you're sitting here and you're new and you can't stand being wrong, you're going to have a hard time here. Because a lot of what we do is realizing where we're wrong. Realizing that this isn't right. When I was brand new, a guy cornered me after a meeting, and this guy Joe, and Joe said to me, he said, "Kid," he said, "you need to take step three." And I said to Joe, "I can't take step three." And he says, "Why not?" I said, "Well, the truth is, Joe, I don't believe in God." He said, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." I said, "Well, Joe, it kind of says step two came to believe, step three turned our will and our life over to the care of God. I don't have any of that." He says, "Kid, you don't have to believe in God to take step three." I says, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair," and he points to a chair, he says, "I promise you an instantaneous miracle." So I said, all right, I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle?" He says, "Well, the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot." And I didn't even get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah. Bill Wilson says something that is so funny. I was sober 25 years before I got this piece, this little funny line he says. It's at the very end of a section in the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. He says, "We've been talking to you a lot about problems." And then he goes, tells you why. He says, "Well, it's because we are problem people." I have a friend who considers himself a golf person. That's all he thinks about. It's golf, 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 golf. Did you ever see that movie, Sixth Sense, where that little kid walks around and goes, "I see dead people. I see problems. Oh, yeah. I see problems. And it's always in the future. And there's things I haven't, now that I'm thinking about it, I really am glad I'm paying attention to this possibility, because this could be very dear, very dangerous. And I'm continually trying to solve problems that don't exist. I'm constantly trying to clear up the wreckage of my future, because the ego has nothing to do if it doesn't have problems to work on. It's like a crazy little monkey that just needs to be monkeying with stuff. What would happen if I really trusted God and I woke up to the great reality that there is no problems? As Chamberlain used to say that over and over again. I didn't know what he meant. He used to say, he says, "You don't have to worry about yourself. That's God's job. You got to go help God's kids." He said one time, one of the worst things we said to each other in AA was to let go and let God. He says, "Let God do what? He's already done it." What if there really isn't any problems, and that's just the chatter that's convincing you there is, so that you'll be playing God again in your life? What if it's not true? What if things are really and truly absolutely perfect right this second? And they always will be right this second. And you only ever live right this second. And it never will change. you'll just imagine from time to time that there's stuff happening. And if you listen to it, you'll get back in there and you'll start playing God. And you know how that is. We can make stuff happen. Do you ever get up in the morning with a feeling of impending doom, like that feeling like, oh, there's some bad stuff going to happen today? And isn't it amazing how you kind of become like a magnet for that stuff? Because the book says, did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? When I was new, I was having a really, really bad day. Now, in truth, there was nothing bad going on at that moment. But I'm telling you, I could see some stuff on the horizon that was horrific. I knew, now that I was thinking about it, I could tell my boss didn't like me. He says he likes me, but you know how they are. You can't trust them. I knew that some of the other employees had been talking behind my back. There was a girl that I was dating, and now that I'm thinking about it, I think she's cheating on me. I don't have any evidence of that, but I kind of know. You know, it's like there was another speaker said how we could read minds. I could read minds. I knew there was problems going on. I suspected I had a brain tumor, but I wasn't. Again, it came back. I had all these problems. And I'm telling this guy this stuff, and he says, you think that you are your thoughts and your mind, don't you? You think you're your head, don't you? I said, yeah, it's me. It's my thoughts. It's my mind. He said, that's not you. No? He said, no. You're the idiot that listens to it. I have a friend who's a biblical scholar, and she's a bright gal. She's a bright gal, and she's read the Bible, the Old Testament, in the original Hebrew. And she's told me, she said, it's a different book. It's not like the fundamentalists and a lot of the preachers think. It's a different book. You read it in the original language. And she said in the Garden of Eden, in Genesis, when it talks about the serpent, if you were to literally translate the word that they use from the Hebrew into the English, it would not translate as the word serpent. The word they used was the word to describe the sound the serpent made. It's the hiss and the slither. It never goes away. You can't see it, but you can hear it. It just talks to you all the time. It chatters to you. It says things like, don't listen to your sponsor, they're old. It says things to you like, that book was written in the 30s, for God's sakes. What do they know about you? You know, it just talks to you nonstop. And that is the voice of the enemy. And that is what I have to get my life out of its hands. And I'll tell you what my experience has been. My ego, in order to get me in the driver's seat again, has to scare me. It doesn't. You don't get a guy like me who's trying to live AA into playing God and being the actor trying to run the whole show just like that. You have to worry me into that position. And I don't even know what's happening to me. And fear is the muscle of the ego. If my ego wants me to jump through hoops, it wants me to control, wants me to play God, it's got to scare me. And when I'm really trying to trust God, and I don't do it as well as I'd sure like to, what seems to happen to me, if I'm in fit spiritually conditioned, that means anything, my amends, I'm clear, I'm clean, I'm current with my sponsor, not perfect. It seems like the chatter in my head, I'm placed in, as it talks about in step 10, in a position of neutrality. It seems to recede and chatters at me like music in a doctor's office. It's there, but it's not here. You get me scared, and it's here. And then it owns me again. And I guess I'm going to be the guy who always needs a sponsor. I'm going to be the guy who always needs commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm always going to need the accountability of people to sponsor. Because this never has gone away. At the very, very best, I can show up. And it seems like the last 10 years of my sobriety, I've gotten a little better at showing up as and acting as if God's really got me. because that's all that matters here is how I act. You know, I try not to show up as an ego-dominant guy in AA, and I've been that guy in AA. I've been the producer of confusion rather than harmony, the guy who talks crap behind people's back. Why does the ego do that? I'll tell you, because it wants to grandize itself and puff itself up at the expense of others. I try to be a good example to the guys I sponsor because they watch you. I'm not perfect. But I've done some things in my sobriety where I've been really ashamed of because I realized I was a bad example to the guys I sponsor. One of the great things I've done ever since I got here is I've done 12-step work. I've done hospitals, I've done institutions nonstop, usually two a week now for over 34 years. And I love, that is my meat and potatoes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll see stuff in Las Vegas in detoxes and county jails that you won't see anywhere else in AA, I don't think, on the planet. You'll see the guys from Northern California and New Jersey and Florida and Iowa that were sober 35 years that drank again. Vegas calls you. And Vegas, doesn't matter. You could have $4 million in your IRA. Vegas will take it away from you quicker than you can believe possible. These guys end up in our county jail. They end up in our detox. And they're me. They are me. My ego would like to say I'm superior, I'm smarter, I've learned, I've done, I've. No, the truth is, if I have the same sickness they have, what could happen to them could happen to me. And I interview guys that go out after a number of years. I've been doing it for decades now. I want to know what you weren't doing, and I want to that you should have been doing, and I want to know what you were doing you shouldn't have been doing. Because I believe if I'm walking down the same road you walk down, I'll see the same stuff you see, and I'll react to it the same way, and what could happen to you could happen to me. And service in Alcoholics Anonymous, you think you're helping the new guys. They're saving your life. They're saving your life. There's a line in our book that says we have the seeming inability to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering of even a week or a month ago. I am. I have a great life. And it's lulled me into a sense of okayness that is not founded on any reality. I need to relive my alcoholism through those that I would help. They bring it right into my face and make it real again. And I need that. I don't ever want to forget where I came from. I don't ever want to grow above what I have here, which is a chronic spiritual condition called alcoholism. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not have identified with anything I've said here tonight. That's okay. There'll be other speakers. There'll be one tomorrow morning. There'll be meetings of speaker meetings all week in your town and your communities. Go to other meetings. You'll hear someone that will light you up and you'll connect with them. Because we got a wrench for every nut in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you did identify with me at all, God help you. You need AA very, very badly, I'm telling you. But if you did, I want you to know that there is a treatment here for the insanity of alcoholism once I put down the bottle. Because I'm an alcoholic. If all I do is get rid of the alcohol, I'm left with the ick. Come and join us and get your hands and get your life out of the hands of the idiot. Thanks for listening.
Hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll free 1-877-893-2777, or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.